In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with just one co-host today, Evan Ratliff.
Hey, Max.
Hey, man.
We're missing one.
We are. We're a man down.
He's got a bad back, and it's gone out on him again. Yeah, That's what's happened.
He is literally down. He's down on the floor right now in his apartment because he cannot stand up.
Send him some well wishes, listeners, if you...
At Aaron Lammer on Twitter, aaron@longform.org. The man is in some pain.
We're hoping that he's going to be back very soon, and it's a shame that he's not here because this is actually... his interview. So, Max, who did Aaron speak to this week?
This week, Aaron spoke to Anne Helen Peterson of BuzzFeed. Anne Helen Peterson writes all kinds of great stuff for BuzzFeed. She wrote this piece, this big piece on TMZ, like right before all the Ray Rice stuff.
Piece.
Yeah, it was great. But before she was at BuzzFeed, she was working on these great pieces about scandals of classic Hollywood. She wrote them for The Hairpin, and those and some other stuff have been collected into a book, also called Scandals of Classic Hollywood, and it is out this week.
This book looks really fun to
read. Evan is holding
like
his hands
a story
right
about
now.
Fatty Arbuckle's descent from Hollywood royalty, fueled by allegations of a boozy orgy turned violent assault. It's like full of these kind of stories.
Come on,
it's
buy
fantastic.
That book. Yeah. Boozy orgy. Come on. One note for the chronology sticklers out there: Aaron and Annie spoke a couple weeks ago, and they're talking about this book as though it's going to come out in the future. But we are now. The future is here.
The book is out.
The moment has arrived.
You can go purchase the book right now.
Go get it.
Sponsors?
Oh, we got them. Here's one thing you could do, Evan. You're a fashionable man of style, man of taste. Have you gone to bonobos.com?
Not today.
It is bonobos.com, B-O-N-O-B-O-S.com. I really like saying that. If you use the code LONGFORM, you can buy some of their fantastic men's clothing for 20% off.
One of our other sponsors this week is one of Aaron's very favorite sponsors. It's Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. And as Aaron is fond of telling me, even not on the podcast at all, just incidentally.
Just walking around the office.
If you want to tell a group of people about something, you should do it with an email newsletter. There's a lot of great email newsletters floating around out there, including by people who've been on this podcast. And all of them are made with Tiny Letter. So check it out. It's from MailChimp.
One more sponsor, a stalwart sponsor, another consistent sponsor on the show, EA Sports, our favorite video game, FIFA. They've got a new version out. It's EA Sports FIFA 15, and we've been doing this contest to find our listeners and our readers' favorite soccer articles. The results are up, Evan.
Who is the winner? What is the best soccer article?
You're going to be happy to know this. It's a Howler article.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know which article you're talking about.
Yeah, it's great. You should go. We'll put it in the show notes. It's up on longform.org. Some great articles, and EA Sports was kind enough to give away an Xbox as well.
That's fantastic. Also, this article it's about the time a fan was enlisted to play for an English soccer team.
I don't know. I'll be honest. I had not read it before. Many people voted for it.
It's amazing.
Here's Aaron with Anne Helen Peterson.
Welcome, Anne Helen Peterson.
Hi.
Hey. I think the first writing of yours that I became aware of was the Hollywood Scandals series you did for It's Hairpin, right?
The Hairpin, yeah.
Yeah. What I sort of, I know a little bit about your background. Maybe we can reverse engineer it. So at what point in your life and career did you start just writing stuff for the web?
I was getting my PhD in media studies in Austin, Texas. And it was the summer between my second and third year, and I was studying for my comprehensive exams, which meant that every day I just picked a book and read that book.
Yes.
For like in one day. And then like obsessively took note cards and then like put the note cards all over my room. Like it was very something out of.
Do you think that this kind of behavior is influenced by like cult behavior? I mean,
oh my gosh.
it's not a logical way
to
test.
It was an amazing way. It was the most gratifying experience of my entire scholastic career.
Because it's training you for a skill that literally has no applications.
Oh, except
like
for writing for the internet.
Yeah, except for writing the internet. So you were doing this, at which point you were like, I actually could get rich because I could write like 50 posts in a single day.
I had no idea. But that's not why I started writing for the internet. The moral of the story is that it's a very isolating experience to be reading a book every day by yourself.
Yes.
And so I wanted some way to attach what I was reading in these books, which they were all like history of Hollywood, history of stardom, history of television, this sort of thing. Okay, so how do these things relate to the things that I'm thinking about and what I want to write my dissertation about, which mm-hmm. was the history of the gossip industry. So I came up with a WordPress blog that was called Celebrity Gossip Academic Style, because that is, I guess, what I do.
Yeah.
And so I started writing on this, and I had like joined Twitter, I don't know, like 6 months before. I had like 200 followers. So like I'd write a post and I'd get like 200 hits. I'd be like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
But this was also the heyday, in quotes, of academic blogging. So lots of other people had blogs and people would write comments, like lengthy comments, and you'd get in conversation. But it taught me how to make the ideas that I was reading into things that were accessible, not just to my academic friends, but to like whoever else on Facebook would click on that link that I shared.
Where did this interest in the history of Hollywood start for you?
If anyone has read my piece on Entertainment Weekly that's in the All, then they know my dirty secret, which is that I was obsessed with Entertainment Weekly from like the very first issue. And I obsessively cataloged it. Like I made a database on my Apple IIe where I put in like the title of the magazine and the number and whether it was a little E or a big E on the cover and the different topics. And then I gave it a grade.
Whoa.
Like, you know, in Entertainment Weekly, they give everything a grade. So I'd be like, Oscars issue, A-.
Like,
but I learned how to track, to be obsessively track Hollywood industry, even though I grew up in a very small town in northern Idaho. Like, I had no idea.
What was your relationship to, like, Hollywood and that world? I mean, when you were grading these magazines, what were you thinking? How were you thinking that you related to them, I guess?
You know, and I was never a cinephile. A lot of people who are in cinema studies like grew up watching old movies with their parents, or like their dad loved to watch John Wayne movies. Like at least they got an experience of that. Like that was not me at all. I mean, the movies that we watched in my house were Rad, which is a BMX movie, Ski Patrol, which is a Ski Patrol movie.
It's like Rad on skis.
It is. And then like the Star Wars trilogy just on repeat and Big. But what Entertainment Weekly taught me was like the entire landscape of the industry. And as, you know, any type A nerdy, bored 11-year-old knows, like you can apply that to anything, like whether that's video games or I mean, some kids are really into weird politics. I was really into the Iraq War, like the first Iraq War. Like I cut all these clippings and stuff.
What grade did you give it?
I think the Iraq War was like fourth grade. And that was right about the time of the Entertainment Weekly obsession, too.
Yeah.
But so I knew like everything about like Sex Lies videotape, which I didn't watch until I was 19 years old. But I knew all about like the Weinsteins and what was going on in Sundance and that sort of thing.
Did you have ambitions to turn this into like a like intellectual like career pursuit at that point?
Or no.
What took you from here to there?
My mom's a mathematician, my dad's a doctor. Like I was a huge mathlete, so I thought I was gonna be a math major in college. And then the first semester, this is so cliche, but like the first semester I was in like Calc 4 so bad. And I also got kind of like accidentally into a film class, a Westerns class. I had no interest in it, but like the way that thinking that I could actually study cinema as like an aesthetic pursuit really opened up for me. And so that first semester, I was like, here's something that gives me a lot of pain and that I don't like anymore. And here's this new thing that I'm really good at. So
yeah.
Maybe I should think about that some more.
When you write something for the All,
yeah.
your stakes are or the Hairpin, rather, the stakes are generally to entertain a reader on
yeah.
some level,
yeah.
at a basic level. When you're turning in a 400-page dissertation, what are the stakes of that kind of writing for
that's,
you?
That's a really good question. I mean, the stakes were not to entertain. I was always getting kind of in trouble, for lack of a better word, for writing too journalistically.
Ah, interesting.
Whereas, you know, the typical or established and valorized way that you're supposed to write academic writing is more like an interrogation, but not like a sexy interrogation,
right.
more like a passive voice interrogation of what's going on.
I generally hate academic writing, but I haven't quite figured, like, I always want to ask people, like, what did you think you were doing
yeah.
when you wrote this
yeah,
way?
Yeah.
And what, like, what the person who's like, hey, tone down the fun in this one. Like, it's a little bit like it's a little bit too coherent as a narrative. What are they saying is lost there, and what is it that they want that's not that?
I think that seriousness, like actually taking a step back and yeah. analyzing, okay, so what is this story and what's at stake in telling this story is one of those things, which I think is good.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really invaluable, one of the pieces of advice that was really invaluable to me was I was getting a lot of the information on, you know, like, the history of what was going on at People magazine and that sort of thing. I was getting it from the trades, especially so, like, there's this whole chapter in my dissertation that's about, like, the celebrity death match of the early 2000s.
I really enjoyed that one.
Between Us Weekly and People magazine. It is so fascinating, and I really want to write about it more. But the thing is that this was all being covered not only in, like, Variety and Hollywood Reporter, like, the Hollywood trades, but also in the magazine trades, so places like Folio and Ad Age and Ad Week and Brand Week and all these different places. And they absolutely had something at stake in inflating the sense that this was a Hollywood, like, that these two magazines, that there actually was a story here.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, of course.
And so, like, to take a step back and be like, instead of, oh, okay, so this is what was going on, to be like, so here was, you know, this way I'm getting all of this information is actually mediated through these sources, which are themselves, those sources themselves have a stake in it.
They're players in the
yeah,
drama.
Totally.
When you take something like classic Hollywood, less so when we're talking about like Entertainment Weekly or TMZ, when you take like classic Hollywood
yeah.
As a topic, this has to be a topic that, like, we could, like, fill your Brooklyn apartment up with books about it that have already been written.
It's, like, all the way filled up with those books.
Yes.
Right now.
So, yeah. All the books that you're someday going to sell on Amazon,
right.
filling your apartment. And you got 800 books there. How do you sort of carve out what's new among
yeah.
that? And, like, your mentor has this argument about the studio system, which right. is basically that they're sort of creativity within limitations,
mm-hmm.
to paraphrase my
yeah.
very brief memory
yeah,
of that.
Yeah.
Can you not then write a dissertation that makes the same argument? I mean,
no,
do you have
can't.
To come up with a completely new idea?
Well, that's why, like, the very beginning of any dissertation is the super long and super boring lit review.
Yeah.
Because it's like, here's all the arguments that I can't steal. Like,
right.
I have to acknowledge and stand on the shoulders.
Yeah, it's sort of like a disclosure.
People.
Like,
yeah.
like disclosure, it, like, almost everything in this has already been covered. But, like, deep in it, there may be one new thing.
I mean, the to be honest, the hit, like, people writing scholastic, academic, engaged histories of Hollywood is actually pretty relatively new.
Like, how old is media studies? Like, the 60s?
Film studies is from, like, really, like, early 70s, and it's
ah,
an offshoot
okay.
of English. But then you have, like, McLuhan and communications and that sort of thing. That's kind of, like, a different realm.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, media studies, even now, you have the kind of the more traditional film studies, and then you have cultural studies, which is developing in the 70s, which is like, oh, let's look at popular stuff instead of just, like, Swedish art cinema.
Right.
And that's where, to some extent, some of my stuff fits in, because I'm like, let's talk about celebrities as images and as things that people consume, and also, like, the study of television is in there. And then you have more of, like, the comm studies branch of it as well. I mean, it's super multidisciplinary, which is part of what's attractive about it.
What point did ideas from your, like, dissertation start bleeding into writing that you were doing outside of your dissertation?
I mean, everything that I was doing was all gossip, like was all celebrity and gossip related. So it was all this like cluster of everything was similar. And so no matter what I was writing, I mean, like Scandal's a classic Hollywood. The first one that I wrote for the Hairpin, I wrote the week after I turned in my dissertation. And I was like, I'm so sick of writing in this tone. I just want to write like with a lot of exclamation marks.
Right.
And at this time, you know, this is pretty soon after the Hairpin started. I think it was like 3 or 4 months old. And this is when Edith Zimmerman was the editor. And like there's a very...
Check out her long form podcast.
There's a very like Edith style that's still to some extent the house style of the Hairpin. But I was just in love with it and had like read it all through like the dog days of my dissertation. And I had never submitted anything anywhere.
Yeah.
I wrote like 2,000 words about Ingrid Bergman, because that's a story I like know backwards and forwards in that style. And I was so nervous, and I sent it to Edith and I was like, maybe this. She's like, I love it. It's going up tomorrow. And I think it got like 30 comments, and I thought it was the best thing in the universe.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsors this week. The first sponsor is Bonobos. This is a true story. Here's a true story. A couple weeks ago, Bonobos was a sponsor on the podcast for the first time. And shortly thereafter, I got a call from my mother. And my mom likes to buy me clothes sometimes. And she said, have you heard of this company, Bonobos? And I said, I have. They, in fact, sponsored the podcast. And she doesn't listen to the podcast because she doesn't care. But she was excited about Bonobos. And she said, I want to buy you some clothes. These clothes look great from Bonobos. And I said, you should use the code LONGFORM at checkout and you'll get 20% off. And she did that. And I now have Bonobos clothing. Thanks to my mother, because she takes care of me. She doesn't listen to the podcast, but she does take care of me. Anyway, Bonobos. They make everything from perfect-fitting chinos, denim, and shirts to world-class hats and outerwear options. Go to Bonobos today. That's BONOBOS.com. And you, like my mother, can use the code LONGFORM at checkout, and you'll get 20% off. Thanks so much to them for sponsoring the show and for these clothes. Thanks also to my mother. And thanks to EA Sports, our second sponsor this week. EA Sports, always supportive of the podcast. They just gave away an Xbox and a free copy of EA Sports FIFA 15 to one of the entrants to our contests. But they didn't want everyone to feel empty-handed. So they're going to give away 10 more copies of the game. That's 10 copies, either PlayStation or Xbox, of FIFA 15. All you got to do is send us an email, editors@longform.org. Put FIFA 15 in the subject line, and we will send you a game, a free copy of EA Sports FIFA 15. Thanks so much to them for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to Aaron and Anne Helen Peterson.
What were the challenges of trying to go from like dissertation to exclamation mark in your writing?
I mean, that came naturally. I think it was like, because I had been blogging this whole entire time. Like, I had read a blog post probably every, like, three times a week. So that, I still had, like, that muscle hadn't atrophied. You know how when you read something, you read it, like, you read it all the time, that you just incorporate that style? Like, I used to tell students that, like, the way to learn how to use a semicolon is just to read, like, a lot of Henry James.
Absolutely.
And so I had been reading so much of the Hairpin that it was very natural to like
to write in that style.
Yeah, and it's also like kind of this like Corey style as well, of like the enthusiasm that's not ironic, it's actual enthusiasm. And I was really excited about Ingrid Bergman and this crazy scandal.
Yeah.
And so it came really naturally. The one hesitation, and I still have this all the time, is that the story is really nuanced, of like why things happened the way that they did. And, you know, people have written a lot about it, and I have thought a lot about it. And if you're trying to say all of that in 2,000 words, and especially if any other, like, celebrity studies scholars read it, they would be like, well, what about this? And what about this? And I'd
right.
be like, I wanted to say all those things.
Right.
But word count.
Well, I mean, it was interesting. Like, when I picked up your book, you've got a book that's coming out?
Yeah, September 30th.
September 30th. Book is Scandals of Classic Hollywood.
Scandals of Classic Hollywood. Scandals. All new content.
The part that was interesting for me in reading the book as opposed to them is when you read these stories of these stars' sort of generally misfortunes, almost almost no one likes something awesome to happen
to. The only people who have awesome things happen to them are like straight, white, skinny males.
Yes. Glad that you put the skinny on there.
Because now it's Patty Arbuckle.
Yeah. Yeah. But so the impression I got when I read the book, as opposed to like the 2,000 word slivers, is you start to see a pattern among the behavior, which is both that the gossip and publicity racket is shaping America's opinion of these stars, but also just generally destroying them in the process, or at least putting them down a path where they are likely to destroy themselves.
Yeah.
You start to see them not as people, but start to see this as like a sort of a history of both American perception and like a class of people, because Hollywood really was like a colony, as you write about in it. When you started taking these pieces that you had done from the web and thinking about putting them into a book, what were the major components that separated the book from the pieces in your mind?
I mean, the great thing about having spent so much time and money on graduate education is that I think of the history of Hollywood stardom as a system. Mm-hmm. And so as something, like, I see all of those valleys and peaks. And, like, the dissertation is, like, about the last 100 years of Hollywood gossip. So the context is all there, and I know where they lie. Each of those stars, that each of them is a chapter. Like, I know where in that system they are and what's going on.
Yeah.
So before any of that happened, like, that it was very clear to me, like, okay, so these three stars are going to be in, like, early, early silent Hollywood when, like, things are really, really fraught. And, like, these stars are going to be in classic Hollywood when everything's covered up. And, like, these stars are going to be transitional stars when, like, everything's going to hell in the 1950s. So, like, that was so easy to map. And I think that in part because, like, the way that I just happened to write the scandals for the Hairpin, it kind of goes all over. Like, the first one's Ingrid Bergman, and I do, like, I think it's Mitchum next. But then I, like, sometimes I'll go way back to, like, Theda Bara in, like, the teens. And then I'll do one on, like, Robert Redford, who's not really a classic Hollywood star, but mostly I just wanted to, like, put pictures of him.
So one thing I was thinking about while I was reading the book was, like, you've got sort of two dogs nipping at your heels. One dog is the, like, dog of, like, academic, like, media studies. Like, I already said that. Like, that idea was there. And then the other dog is, like, the Wikipedia dog, which is, like, these stories are well known. Like, you could get a lot of that Fatty Arbuckle story.
But it's wrong.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you about. So there's so much misinformation about there. And there's so much, like, these are people who have already been widely biographied.
Right.
How do you separate all of that out and, like, say, this is, like, how I'm going to describe Fatty Arbuckle's life? Like, what are the trusted sources when you're doing something like this?
Yeah. I mean, each star, not every star, but many of them have had, like, a really good academic article, if not book, published on them. So part of what I'm doing is standing on their shoulders in that way. But a lot of those are also, like, the really good one about Fatty Arbuckle contextualizes his story with the Black Sox scandal. I'm not making that same argument. Like, right. I'm going to say some of the same things about what the attitude towards kind of censorship and regulation and the way that people were talking about fatness and abundance and that sort of thing in, like, early 20s Hollywood. But that's only part of what's informing what I'm doing. Because really what I'm excavating isn't, okay, who was Fatty Arbuckle and, like, or what actually happened in that hotel room in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I mean, that, like, for the purposes of my book, it does not matter, because what does matter is the way that these scandals were mediated. And so that is what I can excavate really thoroughly, in part because just over, like, this book took me a summer to write. It would have taken me, like, 5 years to write even 5 years ago, because what happened is that so many of the fan magazines have been digitized and PDF searchable now. So, like, I have all of them.
People who got their PhD like 20 years ago must hate you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I hate myself now, because even when I was doing my dissertation, no fan magazines. I had to, like, sit in the basement of the University of Texas base, like with the microfiche machine, just, like, killing my eyes. And then I spent so much money on fan magazines that you can't get a hold of, because no one, like, historically, this is a whole nother podcast, but historically, the fan magazine has been thought of as trashy, and so no magazines kept it. So there's only like five magazines that have like a full run of Photoplay, which is like the most bourgeois and People magazine type magazine. And all the rest are like in people's basements, like you have to buy them on eBay, like get them at estate sales, that sort of thing. But it's so rich, like the way that people talk about these stars in their scandals is just like that is the font of information on how things happened.
I would say that the theme, if there is one, of the book is repression of a sort and, a sanitization. Coming from a small conservative town, I mean, is that, do you compare your experiences growing up to that sort of sanitized world? Is that like, is that a connection for you?
That's so good. I've never thought of that. I mean, I grew up really Presbyterian. Like I was full Jesus for a long time. But also my parents were intellectuals. So trying to reconcile like the way that my parents understood Christianity and the way that like the church and youth group and like things like ideologies like true love waits and that sort of thing, how that reconciled with my intellectual understanding of like how sex works and like feminism and that sort of thing. I mean, it all exploded as soon as I got to college, which makes sense. But
I feel like you could just take that as the as a quote about anything. It all exploded when I went to got to college.
But yeah, no, I think that like, I mean, looking back, I see that like the repression of all of high school activities, like eventually that leads to sadness and despair and like, you know, people not living up to the expectations that they set for themselves and that sort of thing.
Well, the thing I took from the book was that the whitewashing that goes on, everyone kind of passes the buck. No one's like, I'm the conservative one who wants America to be sexless. Like the people who work for the tabloids are like, well, we're just giving people what they want. They want a sanitized version of these stars. And the censors are like, we're just doing this for the theater owners or, you know, like we're doing
for
this.
The Catholics.
Yeah, the audience wants that. Everyone is sort of saying someone else wants this.
Right.
I'm simply the vessel for the will of the people.
Which actually is complicated because they would say that, but then what would happen, like the censorship that was going on in the 20s, is that like the bishops would say, like, my parishioners don't want to see this like scandalous material. But then the bishops would have to show up like at the theater to make sure the parishioners didn't actually see the scandalous material. And there were, you know, one of the great things about having access to these newspapers is they would reprint the sermons.
Yeah.
So like pastors were denouncing Fatty Arbuckle in the pulpit. So there were some people who were like owning it.
There were some people who get into it.
Yeah, and, like Ingrid Bergman was denounced on the Senate floor.
Right.
As an instrument of evil. Like that senator, he was owning it. She was horrible.
So, I mean, when you're dealing with like an industry like gossip that's literally only exists to obfuscate the truth.
Yeah.
Do you have tools for sort of detecting truth?
I don't know if it only exists to obfuscate the truth. I was doing the polite no, and I was like, no.
Okay, doesn't only exist to obfuscate the truth, but by definition must in some ways be obfuscating the truth, or it would simply be journalism.
No, because I think sometimes gossip is trying to illuminate the truth.
Right.
Because if you're gossiping about like someone, this person is gay, right, is closeted, you're trying to illuminate what has been obfuscated by the publicity apparatus.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But a lot of times it is.
But
like,
you know, it's like, you know, you're getting like a mixed bag. Yeah. Like some of them are jalapenos. Some of them have the super spicy sauce.
Right.
You know, they're not all super spicy sauces.
Right. Or like something like a blind item, which is my favorite kind of gossip because the reason I like gossip is because it's like a puzzle.
Yeah.
I don't actually care, again, if like this is true. It's more like me thinking about like, who is this talking about?
Yeah.
And so a blind item, they are clearly obfuscating who the subject of the blind item is. They're giving you like little hints and that sort of thing. But that's the titillation is the obfuscation.
When you look at like a blind item from 1930, are you able to reconstruct sort of how the sausage gets made there? Like who reports the tip and how they publish? Like I know you've written like about TMZ recently, and it's like I wouldn't say it's like totally transparent, but you have a pretty good idea of how TMZ operates. Like they have like
tipsters.
Freelancers and tipsters, and there's guys with cameras at the airport. Like you can kind of see how they put together the show. Like, are you able to get that detailed with classic era gossip?
Well, you know, like a blind item in 1930 isn't a blind item the way that we think of it today. Like, my favorite contemporary gossip site is called Lainey Gossip. It's this Canadian woman who does
Lainey
like,
Gossip?
Lainey Gossip. But she does like analysis. Like, she is kind of, I mean, she's not an academic, but it's more like smart gossip. So she, every once in a while, will just like post a blind item. There'd be like alliteration and, you know, like, and people, there's a Facebook page where everyone goes and like immediately guesses it and that sort of thing. But in the 1930s, what would happen is like there would be, in a fan magazine, there would be several columnists and they would have kind of bon mots and paragraphs where they would talk about things. Or like Walter Winchell would do the same thing in his like daily column. And it would be more like the way that they would do phrasing. And so the gossip column, they knew everything that was going on. They knew everything. And part of it was that the other stars like reported on one another to keep in those gossip columnists' good graces. And they were moralizers. And so they would like tip their hat that they knew something oftentimes in a gossip, like in a column.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the my favorite would be like in the 1950s, this guy Mike Connolly, who was the gossip columnist for The Hollywood Reporter, was gay. He would, like, when someone who was gay was out with a kind of a sham girlfriend, he would put, like, female name of the person this person was on a date with and Montgomery Clift, and then an ampersand, and then, like, the name of the person that he was actually, that he's dating, like, actually with, and then the name of that person's beard. So if you were, like, if you were in the know, then you would know that there's, like, the two men with the ampersand in between, that's the actual couple. But, like, if you were just reading the paper, then you would never know.
Your bio in the back of the galley of your book says that you are you work at a university and live in Walla Walla.
I mean, I used to.
So you're here now, and you don't look like you have any bags. So what has happened
like
since?
Like any suitcases.
No suitcases. You do have a bag. You don't have a suitcase. So what has happened in your life since that bio was written that has you living
depressed
in New York?
I didn't get a job. So and that's like not news. Like you can read all about it on the internet.
You did not get a job.
I did not get a job.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you got a job.
No,
here.
I did not get a job in academia. So I was on what's called a visiting assistant professorship, which like it doesn't mean that I was like invited special guest. Visiting in academia means like pinch hitter.
Yeah.
So when someone goes on sabbatical or when they're going to like make a tenure track hire, they'll hire a visiting. And so I was on like a 2-year visiting professorship and was interviewing for the job at Whitman College, which is also my alma mater. And I'm obsessed with like Walla Walla, which is this tiny town in Washington State. But I didn't get the job. They gave it to someone who's very qualified, who I know from University of Texas. But I was on the job market. You know, I had not only applied for that job, but I applied for 50 other jobs.
Right.
And it just so happened that like on one of these job interviews that I was contacted by Summer Ann Burton, who I knew vaguely from Austin and whose work I had followed for a long time. And she's like, why don't you write something on Jennifer Lawrence for BuzzFeed? And so I started working on that. And then that hit it was like the day before the Oscars. And the piece is about like the history of cool girls. It's very like what I do, which is like, let's take a contemporary celebrity and then let's add some context about things that have happened in the past. And it went crazy. Like, I think I kind of understood at the time how crazy it went, but
What is going crazy mean
It 1.3 million views for a long form. It was like a 7,000 word piece.
That's more reading than happens in some states in all day.
And I mean, part of it is that BuzzFeed is just a megaphone. Like, that's the metaphor that people use to describe. Just, like, you have so many people who just, like, open the app when they're bored or go to the homepage and whatever's there. And Jennifer Lawrence is, like, so eminently clickable. But the stats on it are actually surprising. Like, the number of people who read actually all the way through it is very high. And so that changed the landscape for me and opened up possibilities that I didn't think were possible. But in the meantime, like, while I didn't think I was going to get an academic job. Like, I'm just, the things I study are really offensive to a lot of traditional departments. Like, they think it's too silly to study gossip and not legitimate.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I thought, like, studying, like, low culture was kind of in now.
It depends. So a lot of, like, at, like, liberal arts colleges where they have one person teaching film studies, it's in the English department. The 60-year-olds in the English department don't think that what I'm studying is cool.
Right.
Like, you know, at a huge university, maybe.
Right.
But, like, that position, you know, there's 100 other people who are applying for that position who are, like, doing really cool research on, like, email use in, like, Tunisia. So the kind of competition for what students love, I mean, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you could offer, like, a course on, like, the history of TMZ and, like, set a university on fire with the registration.
No, I mean, like, my classes were always, like, super, like, waitlisted for just crazily waitlisted, and
kids love me.
Students love me. Give me a job. Well, and that's the thing that I miss about academia most is that I really love teaching. Like, really like it.
Really?
Oh yeah.
You're the first person on the show who's ever said that.
What?
I think. Yeah.
It's so fun.
Yeah.
It's really energizing, and it keeps me hip and young and cool to, like, well, now I don't need that because everyone at BuzzFeed is 22. Kid, but it makes me want to think about the things that I should be thinking about. And I get that, like nervous in my stomach feel, like, before I teach, which I know is, like, the way that I can tell, like, I love it.
So now that you are read by, like, 10 million people, like, does that start feedback loop start to affect your writing? Like,
No. I think it would, you know, if I were still writing at the Hairpin, say, like, that community is so much smaller that you are, like, you read the comments. Like,
I thought you were going to say smarter when you said smaller.
Yeah, well, no, at BuzzFeed, like, there are people who, lots of people who read BuzzFeed get it, obviously.
Yeah.
But then sometimes there are people who are, like, why are you saying that Jennifer Lawrence isn't cool? Like, you just, you know, don't get it. But I just, the reach is too broad to feel like there is a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
To go back to, like, the academia thing. So, like, when I left, I mean, it was a huge decision. It felt like the right decision. But I was super ashamed because it's a huge failure. You feel like it's a huge failure.
It seems like such a success to me. Even now that you've told me it's a failure, I still consider it a success.
Well, and the funny thing, and that I had to, like, have people outside of academia tell me, is that, like, it's a success if you hodgepodge together, which people have to do because there's just not opportunities. You hodgepodge together, like, 7 community college classes that you're driving all over the city. You don't have health insurance. You're getting paid $2,000 a class. So you're, like, below poverty wage, but you're like, I'm not a failure.
Right.
Right? Because I haven't left academia. And so I just had to, like, fuck it and just, like, be liberated from any of that shame. But it took a while.
At what point did you stop, like, sort of feeling the sting of the failure and start feeling the, like, sweet burn of page views?
Well, I think that when I announced that it was happening, so I did this big interview on the Hairpin that was somewhat bombastically but appropriately titled, like, Anne Helen Petersen is leaving academia for BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's appropriate, right?
But yeah, it's good publicity.
It's a big headline.
Yeah.
Which also happened to be released, like, the weekend of, like, the big media studies conference in which I was in attendance. Like, whoa. It was released, like, the first day.
Did you, like, drop, like, a smoke bomb and, like, disappear from the stage?
I spent a lot of time hiding. But when I got I got so many unsolicited emails of, like, this is awesome. This is how I've been feeling. Like, I needed someone to show that there are other options and that sort of thing.
Did you ever think about, like, stepping over a different line and, like, getting into publicity or getting into the gossip industry? I mean, you must know as much about this as many people who work within the industry.
Someone asked me the other day, they're like, hasn't, like, Jennifer Lawrence's people contacted you?
Yeah.
No, I've never had a publicist be like, can you do a seminar on, like, precedent so that we don't keep doing the same things over and over again.
Yeah. They're not interested in
no,
that?
No, not at
I
all.
I didn't even, I wasn't even thinking so much like in terms of like Jennifer Lawrence's right. publicist, but like I would be interested in hiring you if I worked for like TMZ. Like I feel like
right.
there is a circularity to this gossip stuff, and there are some like lessons of the past or even lore of the past
right.
that I think would be interesting.
Well, people are terrified of like the PhD. When yeah. I had to make a resume to apply to BuzzFeed, you know, in academia you have a CV which is like 15 yeah. pages long, and the first thing is like dissertation title and like where you got your PhD. And in 10-point font at the very bottom of my one sheet resume
yeah.
is like PhD.
PhD, all lowercase.
And so I think people, not just in journalism, but kind of across the board, are reticent to think like, oh, here are some people with some marketable skills, in part because PhDs are really bad at marketing themselves in that way, because until recently, until like the system became so broken that like it's clear that we are there's so many out of work PhDs and it's a travesty, and like advisors are like, how can I advise these people? I'm basically telling them to go like to enter a life of poverty. But I never had a seminar on like, here's another, like, here's our other things that you could possibly do with your tremendous skill set that you have acquired.
Did you at some point shift from being like freelance to like staff at BuzzFeed?
No, so they hired me in March and with the knowledge that I would come in the middle of May. So I like gave my last final and then hopped on the plane the next day.
And do you have a quota at BuzzFeed? Like
no.
What's a daily or what's a weekly work cycle at BuzzFeed like?
People that I've talked to now since I've moved to BuzzFeed are amazed that none of us have quotas. I mean, I think that people who do more of what's called like the buzz teamy, so more of the list stuff,
yeah.
they don't have like daily or weekly quotas. It's more like the overarching maxim is like be awesome. And yes, like if you produce things that only get 10,000 hits,
you will get fired immediately.
And you only do that for 6 months.
Yeah.
Then maybe there will be a conversation. But like mine, when I first came in, I was like, I'm going to write a feature every 2 weeks. And they're like, slow down. And because I could write a feature every 2 weeks. But what I've been encouraged to do is to try different things. So like the TMZ piece, like I had to learn how to journalist to do that TMZ
yeah.
piece.
What was your experience of learning to journalize?
Like? I was like, oh, I hate talking on the phone so much, like yeah. so many interviews.
Yeah.
And I just really had to push past that.
I'm curious, like, when you were like, okay, I'm going to do a serious reported piece on TMZ, did you like have to like go up to someone and be like, how do you do that?
Like, well, what happened was those Bieber tapes leaked. Gawker reported that like, yeah. so these Bieber tapes, TMZ had these tapes for everyone. This goes around on an email and like all these people are weighing in, like Jonah Peretti and like Mark Schiff's, like all these people are like, maybe this is extortion, blah, blah, blah. And I just like working on something else kind of haphazardly, like, actually, this has all this precedent, like, Confidential magazine, like, kind of, like, geeky email, and they're
yeah.
like, you're writing a piece. And
yeah.
like, okay. Which I'd already written an academic piece about TMZ.
Yeah.
But I obviously hadn't had access to anyone, because, like, if you call up and you say, I am writing a piece, and I'm an academic, and I'm going to write this piece, like, no one wants to talk to you.
Right.
I mean, people do get access inside the industry, but it was much easier when I was like, I'm writing an investigative piece for BuzzFeed that's going to be like 8,000 words long, and then people kind of, it opened up for me.
That's what I'm curious. Does BuzzFeed open doors? Because I've heard
yes.
like some, like, I think that some of the stuff is changing because like people have been on the show who are like, yeah, like New Yorker, you get a callback, but
yeah.
like Yale, but Gawker, you don't get a callback. You know, that there
yeah.
is like a sort of a entrenched print media versus web,
well, right.
I don't know what the fuck
well,
we're calling
think,
this kind
I mean,
of media. Like, what is TMZ's opinion of getting covered by BuzzFeed?
Well,
like,
from what I understand, they were actually pretty psyched about the piece. Because I do, in this TMZ piece, I'm like, they're the most important media organization of the last 5 years. Like, you know, even though it has kind of all these devious things that they do as well, I also am explaining how, like, they're pretty brilliant in a lot of other ways. But So when I write an email, it's kind of devious. I don't know if it's devious. It's honest. I'm like, I used to be a professor, and now I write. I do journalism for full time, and I'm writing this story for BuzzFeed about DMZ or about whatever.
What's your like intention in saying that you used to be a professor? In that
I think that it really makes people, especially within the industry, it's somehow like they think that I know something, and that I'm going to write something that makes sense and is fair, maybe.
Yeah.
But that's kind of my trick, is that I pair those things together. And I also, I link to like a, like something, like the Angelina Jolie piece that I wrote, which is about her publicity strategy. Like, it shows that I have an understanding of how like publicity works and that sort of thing.
I understand when you're talking about like the classic Hollywood system, you have that entire apartment full of books. But like when you're trying to find out like, yeah, like how does TMZ work? Or mm-hmm. you're trying to find out like, how does like Angelina's Jolie's publicists like actually operate behind the scenes? Like,
yeah,
who do you call? Like, what's the research like for something like that?
So interesting. Like Angelina, that piece on Jolie, I didn't talk to anyone. Like, I didn't talk to her publicist. So it was very much kind of straightforward, like analysis. And what I was looking at is just like the text. Like, here's how, in the months after Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were supposedly getting together after Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and there's all this, like, it could have gone super, super wrong. Here's what images actually emerged. Like, they weren't speaking, they weren't offering comment, but look, here's them on, like, a global philanthropy tour, never appearing in the same shot together, but changing the conversation, the discourse from, like, oh, they're having sex, to look at all of this good that they're doing. So like that, I mean, and that's classic academic. It's like a write around in some ways, except it's like analysis.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, like, we have a lot of people on the show who are not particularly interested in celebrity journalism, but yet have performed it for financial compensation various points in their life. So, I mean, you're kind of coming at it from like an opposite standpoint and saying like, I'm actually really interested in this. Like, I'm not.
Well, I'm not interested in the celebrity profile in its ridiculous, banal form. I wrote this piece, this feature for The Believer in May called The Banality of the Celebrity Profile. And it looks at the incredible history of just how boring celebrity profiles were, and then how they were amazing in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then how they've gone back to boring again. And I, like, it doesn't have to be boring. The problem is that when the magazine holds the journalist to the publicist demands, that's when it's horrible.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually, like, I get less into the, like, are these celebrity profiles good question? But on a deeper level, like, this is an entertainment industry. Like, journalism writing, it's still part of the entertainment industry. Like,
yeah.
The money is from entertainment. You're not getting, like, outside of, like, sort of nonprofit investigative journalism funds.
Right.
It's an entertainment product. And entertainment products are, like, for an audience. An audience kind of defines the terms at which they want it. And clearly, the American audience, the number one thing they want is celebrities. like writers and journalists may not be happy that is, like, how people are wired, but we have like 100 years of history to basically say that's pretty much what people want.
Right. Well, and like the entire, like, the way that Vanity Fair stays in business is all based on that interest.
That didn't even have a question at the end of it, but like, what, like, what's up with that?
But Vanity Fair, like, they have the banal celebrity profile that funds the rest of their excellent investigative journalism.
Absolutely. And that's a tried and true formula. I'm wondering, like, as someone who operates unshamefully in the celebrity realm, like, why is celebrity such a, like, timeless and indelibly entertaining thing? And why are we so uncomfortable? Like, why is that like, people whose job it is to entertain those people find that disdainful?
Okay, two parts. So the stock answer on why we like celebrities is because, like, it's not, I mean, they're beautiful, whatever, like, they embody superlatives and some, like, the most beautiful, the most, the fastest, like, whatever. But, like, the beauty thing falls short because models are beautiful, too, and we're not really interested in models.
Yeah.
So what it is like, we're interested in the image, right? So, like, all this, like, cluster of meanings that, like, a person comes to mean.
Yeah.
And that is always, always a condensation of what like the society is obsessed with, but also has anxiety about. Mm-hmm. So like the phrase is usually like ideologies under threat. So a celebrity can either uphold those and be like, this is what real masculinity looks like, or can challenge them. And so I think that's why, you know, even the relationships and that sort of thing, like you see in something like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's relationship, a new kind of relationship that's being offered forward. So of course you're going to be interested in it. And part of it too is kind of like just age old tropes. Like the fact that like Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie and Jennifer Aniston is essentially a like person for person reworking of the love triangle between Debbie Reynolds, Liz Taylor and Eddie Fisher. Like the way that like one is framed as like this sexual menace, like dark, like all-consuming, like totally enveloping the man, and then the other one is this like all-American girl next door, and the guy is just kind of stoop, like just kind of on the side. So in that way, like things replay themselves, and it's familiar. And but I also think that like gossip, this is where gossip becomes really important in celebrity, is gives people a way to talk about things that actually matter to them by mapping it onto celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can talk about how you feel about this news, like the fact that someone's not getting married or having a baby out of wedlock or like getting divorced. Like that's a way to project your own feelings about something in your own life onto a conversation about something that's seemingly has nothing to do with your life.
Right. And I think in the context of like writers, you know, we pass through this sort of postmodern period where people wanted to deconstruct the celebrity profile, yeah. And you have like the write-arounds are definitely like part of that and kind of commenting on the deep artificiality of the setup.
Yeah.
And like now I think people don't want to do that because that's like now a journalistic cliche in a way to approach a story
that. Alex Papademos did a really good one on Cameron Diaz and Grantland.
Still plays for me. But yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of like maybe some of what people are reacting to, and they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like, not only can I not do it, like, I can't even subvert it, because that's, like, cliche now, too.
Yes.
So I'm sort of interested in whether you see, like, what the path forward you see there is, and in terms of generating your own material.
The other problem is that celebrities are, like, the purpose historically of a celebrity profile is it's, like, illuminating some part of that celebrity that they have not yet disclosed.
Right.
So whatever the soundbite is from the profile, you know, like when like Jennifer Aniston said that like there was a sensitivity chip missing in Brad Pitt, like there's always, you know, like that one thing. With social media, that becomes like the false bottom. So if you do a profile of Kim Kardashian, like everyone already knows everything about Kim Kardashian because her life is her brand.
Right.
Like everything about her being known all the time. So you have to somehow take that profile and go deeper. And I think that's possible. But you have to be really savvy at it. You can't just be like, Kim Kardashian is beautiful.
Right.
Like you have to be really mindful of, okay, so how can I get to something that actually tells me something new and illuminating about Kim Kardashian?
And is that your intention, like when you do something like the Angelina Jolie piece, is to write sort of a reaction, not to the star, but to the way that the star has been constructed? That's a technique
that's
for
why,
talking.
Like, I don't even think the star is necessary.
Right.
You know, like someone will be like, oh, well, can you get access to someone? Does it matter? Isn't it just as interesting that I do it without that star?
Is this stuff changing, or do you see this stuff as like a sort of a like gossip and celebrity sort of a static human condition?
Oh, it's totally a static human condition. I think that it's accelerated and amplified, like just the like digitization, both in terms of how we get our imagery and how fast it goes around. Like, so there's more of it, but the stories are just the same, like over and over and over again.
Do you think that you can keep writing about this forever, or will you run out of stuff? I mean,
in that Cool Girls article, I'm like, Clara Bow is like Carol Lombard, is like early Jane Fonda, like pre-Hannah Jane. Jane Fonda is like Jennifer Lawrence. Like, these are types, and they reproduce themselves in slightly different manifestations. Ben Smith, editor-in-chief at BuzzFeed, like, keeps telling me to, like, do something completely out of my comfort zone, and I don't know what that is. I mean, because to me, I'm not a good journalist in that I don't know how to pitch anything. Like, I never had to, like, write a paragraph where I was like, this is what I want to write about. So, like, in the pitch meetings, I'll be like, Montana. And they'll be like, what about Montana? And I'll be like, I'll figure it out. Like, for me, I like to immerse myself in it, and then the story will, there's something there. Like, yeah. Everything is interesting.
Yeah.
I just need to figure out what that is, but I don't know how to.
Like, I mean, yeah, what else are you interested in? Okay, we got Montana, celebrity. I mean, now that you're doing this as a career,
right?
You must have thought, here's the B plot. I mean,
what is the B plot?
Yeah.
No, really, I haven't. Like, I mean, so like the next piece that I'm working on, which will be out by the time this is out, is on Tinder. I did this giant Tinder simulation and got like 1,000 people to do it and made them like write why they swiped on people and why they didn't. And I made all the Tinder profiles myself.
Okay. So you did have done something outside your wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah. And it's all about, but it's about the same things that I'm always obsessed with, which is identity.
Yeah.
So like this, the thing that I found from this Tinder piece is that it's not about race. Like everyone thinks like, oh, I'm secretly racist and like feels bad about it with Tinder. It's all about class.
And you're getting that not from like a numerical standpoint, but from their statements about why they swiped.
So I have both the statistics about who they swiped on, right?
Yep.
But then also the statistics, I made them when they looked at the picture, I'd be like, what class do you think this person is? What education level do you think this person is? What race do you think this person is? And so you have people that are ostensibly entirely the same. And that they actually even say like similar things about, but it's the class that makes them swipe no.
How do you read class into a Tinder profile?
Well, this is where like it's media studies because it's all about semiotics. It's like how you pick up on these small, tiny things in a profile and think that that person is of a different class. Because the thing that people say in their comments isn't that person is poor.
Yeah.
It's I don't think we would have anything in common. I don't think we would relate well. I don't know what we would talk about.
When you're working on a piece like this and you're like doing a simulation with 1,000 people and like putting in a lot of work and the person at the next desk is doing like a what animal is your date tonight kind of list. That was not even a good fake BuzzFeed.
Like I sit next to Isaac Fitzgerald, who's like the BuzzFeed Books editor. So he's always doing something.
Oh, yeah. But you know, you're on your way to the bathroom.
Right.
And someone's like constructing like what 80s movie says about like your mom. I know people from the outside feel threatened by that. Like I know people who don't work at BuzzFeed or these kind of publications are like, what the fuck? Like I went in the trenches and, you know, I like worked my ass off to get here and like I'm competing with listicles.
The New York Times has a crossword puzzle and a Sudoku and cartoons and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there are fun and it has a style section and it has, you know, like nostalgic things and it has the vows section. Like there's something for everyone.
Yeah.
For like your very, very dense, like takes all of your Sunday morning brain power and like you're hungover. I'm just going to play the crossword and like to fill in two things, brain power. I think that one of the great things about BuzzFeed as a homepage is that someone can go there and they see like, oh, I want to click on this like 29 cats who can't even right now. But then they get led in the same way that like actually reading the New York Times, you'll maybe click on a news story or a business story or something like that that they wouldn't have otherwise seen. And so it's actually, I think, facilitating instead of siloing that sort of like, the internet is only fun or only serious.
Right. I think that the operative difference there is that no one said, you know, The New Yorker, where they have those like funny cartoons about how people don't know how to use iPhones, right?
Right. Well,
and people say BuzzFeed is that place where the lists are, you know?
Right. Well, and that conversation is slowly changing. You know, every time that someone tweets a piece of mine with the beginning, who knew that BuzzFeed did serious journalism, is the last time they can tweet that.
Right. It's kind of the like, graphic novels, they're not just for kids anymore.
But then, so at some point, like, you can't say that anymore because you know.
Right. And it must be somewhat nice for you to have, like, someone entering the site on, like, a list and seeing, like, your piece on the celebrity leaks in the sidebar. It's like money people would love that, like, million link generation.
Well, and I think of it as, like, I don't know if this is too highfalutin, but I do think of it as progressive, because my goal has always been that these ideas that I've had, that I have, like these, yeah, that I've spent all of this time learning in the ivory tower,
yeah,
that they shouldn't be locked there.
Yeah.
Because like if I were to stay in academia and all this, like the books, if I wrote a book, it would only be in academic libraries. And if I like wrote an article, like it would be behind a paywall.
Yeah.
Like not just a pay, like these aren't even like the paywalls of like the New York Times. We're talking like a giant moat to get,
yes,
to these articles, right?
Yes.
And so by writing for other places, I was like, I want to make these accessible. But the Hairpin, like I, and all like, the, you know, those sites are like, you know, my, they're my go-to places, but it's still a relatively circumscribed audience of people who go are led to those sites.
Yes.
But for BuzzFeed, like people want to think intelligently about celebrity.
Right.
Maybe not 100% of people, but a lot of people. And so for them to like realize like here's a way that I can think about this thing in a way that's engaging, like that, like I want to do that. I want to make that accessible for as many people who will read it. And that is much easier at a place like BuzzFeed. Like the energy there is out of this world. I mean, I've just, maybe it's just being in academia for so long where like everyone is sad and like, angry. And like, I mean, in part because there is a poverty mentality and because, I mean, because academia is broken. Of course,
yeah,
people feel broken too.
Yes.
But being at a place where there's plenty and people are excited about the freedom that they have to create things, it's super invigorating.
I have one more question about that, which is,
yeah,
in shifting from doing like a dissertation, your frequency is going way up. I mean, you wanted to do one every 2 weeks, maybe slowing the roll a little bit there.
Oh, but yeah. No, I do like one a month.
So like, let's say the celebrity nude leaks, you know, like a gazillion people are going to do it and maybe you don't care like what they have to say.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I would know, I know just about that sort of spectrum of writing is a lot of it's going to be very knee-jerk and reactionary, and it's
right,
going to be intended for the day it comes out.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about writing something like that, how do you sort of balance the like news cycle versus the eternal question of fame? Is it important to you that your articles be readable years down the,
yes,
line?
Yes. There was an interesting thing in the Alt. Gosh, we're talking about the Alt so much.
I know. This is sponsored branded entertainment.
But there was, John Herman wrote a thing today about like the hot take.
Yeah.
And kind of disparaging it, but also like just its place in the news cycle and how,
yep,
there's always like how, you know, there's 100 hot takes and then like 3 of them become ideas, essentially. The,
right,
ones that endure become ideas. And I think that part of my goal in doing context and like historicizing things, which is a word that I'm supposed to not use because,
yeah,
it makes me sound too academic, but,
yeah,
that's what I'm doing. You add history, that is called historicizing.
That usage is problematized, yes.
But by doing that, it makes it so that it's less ephemeral. So it seems like it can be, it's taking, it's kind of putting tethers into history that makes it more grounded.
I mean, it's actually interesting. I hadn't thought of this, but like when we were talking about academia, we were talking about how like everyone's already like staked out all the campsites. So,
yeah,
you have to like do like the,
yeah,
wacky campsite,
yeah,
like, next to the porta potty to get a new idea.
So smelly there.
And that's sort of the same problem as the hot take. Like,
yeah,
the hot take is like, well, I got a zag here.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to zig.
Yeah.
Like
if I feel like I'm not being influenced by what other people are saying and just trying to say what, you know, what my argument is, then it feels like it's less trying to wedge myself into that nasty smelling campsite.
I feel like I want to keep bringing back the campsite by the porta potty as a metaphor for various things with journalism now.
I'm from the West. I, yeah, totally understand.
And you've done and you've done pieces additionally for like for VQR and for Believer.
Before,
yes.
Yeah.
What I mean, what's like the editing process like between like a BuzzFeed piece and like a Believer piece?
So in academia, like you don't really have editing. You know, when a piece goes out for peer review,
yeah,
it's like
a
lot of
most
times.
Negative
I have had a few very excellent peer reviewers, but the majority are like other academics performatively shitting on your piece, and it's anonymous. So that's, you know, it's part. It facilitates that process, and I just love editors. It's just great. Oh my gosh, being edited is so great. Like, I think that sometimes people, like, a lot of people have fraught relationships with editors, but me, I'm like, that's awesome. That idea that you have to do that, that is great. And like, you're going to make it that I don't have typos, also great. So at BuzzFeed, you know, especially with this TMZ piece, like, it was fact-checked at kingdom come. Like, at some point, so I write everything in Google Docs. There were 20 people in that document because we had, like, lawyers and fact-checkers and editors and people who specialize in entertainment and all sorts of things. So it was thoroughly, thoroughly processed. And it's a better piece for it.
And is it, like, is it different when you're doing kind of like a literary, like, believer VQR kind of piece? Does that get pushed in different directions?
You know, I would say it's very similar. I mean, part, like, Steve, who's my primary editor now, like, you know, he's an old school magazine editor.
Yes.
So he edits very similarly to, like, how I was edited at The Believer and that sort of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And are you going to do, like, a book tour or anything?
I am. There's a book release party.
Yes.
At Powerhouse Books.
Yes.
On my book release date, September 30th, which is also Lena Dunham's book release date. But I am the counter programming.
And they're not at the same venue.
No.
That'd be uncomfortable.
No. And then I'm going to Texas.
Awesome.
I'm going to Seattle. I'm going to Boston. I'm going to a couple of places. Yeah, just a lot of stuff.
I'm glad I asked you that because having you, like, list out your tour dates made me feel like we're doing a real radio show here. Like, you're like a comedian on, like, my Zoo Crew show.
You called me up at 6 a.m.
Yeah, you're at your hotel hungover, and I'm like, about to blow a kazoo to signal that we're about to do traffic. So that seems like as good a place to end as any. Thank you, Anne Helen Peterson.
Thank you so much.
The book is Scandals of Classic Hollywood, September 30th. You can check out most of these pieces at BuzzFeed, and we'll put them in the show notes. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. That interview was done by Aaron Lammer, who is home with a bad back. Aaron, if you are listening to this, may you be prone and pain-free. I feel terrible. I feel terrible, man. His back is really giving this man some trouble. If you want to send him well wishes, you should. Tell him to feel better. He's at Aaron Lammer on Twitter. The other host of this show is Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Rachel Mabe. Thanks so much to Anne Helen Peterson for coming in. Her new book is called Scandals of Classic Hollywood. It involves scandals and classic Hollywood. I don't know how you cannot like that. Go pick up a copy. And thanks also to our sponsors, Bonobos, BONOBOS.com. Use the code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 20% off. Tell them my mom sent you. Thanks also to Tiny Letter and to our friends at EA Sports. They've already given away a free Xbox One to a listener of Longform, but they want to do more. So send us an email, editors@longform.org, put EA Sports FIFA 15 in the subject line, and we will send you a free copy if you're one of the first 10 people. We'll send you a free copy of EA Sports FIFA 15. The new game is great. We've been playing it incessantly in the office. I have a suspicion that all the losing he's been doing, the stress from the losses, is what caused Aaron's back pain this time. We'll see you next week. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.